When we talk about diversity in newsrooms, we often only talk about racial or ethnic diversity. We don't talk about ideological diversity. And we need to get other points of view.
Hi, I'm Gina Cerrito, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Lynn White and Judy Licht. We're the News Broads, broads casting about the news and all things media. We're here to give you insights on how it all works. A look at the news you won't find anywhere else.
We've recently gone through what was arguably the most contentious, if not the most bizarre election in our nation's history. And by now, we kind of know who the president is and who most of the candidates are, most of the winners. But for us at News Broads, the real question is just how good a job did the media do in covering all of this? Well, joining us right now to talk about it is one of, if really not the best media reporters in the country, Ken Auletta. He's covered media for The New Yorker for almost three decades with his Annals of Communication column. He's written 12 books, mostly on this subject, five of them bestsellers, including Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way, The Highwaymen, Warriors of the Information Superhighway, and that's an expression he sort of created it or popularized, at least. Google, The End of the World as We Know It, Backstory Inside the Business of News. Well, you get the idea. Welcome, Ken. We are really glad you're here with us. And obviously the first question, how'd we do? How did the media cover the election? If you were going to give it a report card, what would the grade be? Why?
I would probably give a B. I would give an F to the pollsters to give you a point of comparison. They were uniformly wrong, and we need explanations as to why. Was it their fault? I mean, I don't believe that when Donald Trump said it was a conspiracy on the part of the pollsters to help the Democratic candidates by suppressing Republican votes was kind of silly. But was it because Trump voters are shy and don't want to admit that they're voting for him? I don't know the answer, but there's something wrong. And of course, they got it wrong in 2016. They got it more wrong this time when they predicted basically a landslide. The press was tough on Trump, pointing out his lies, and they didn't shy from using the word lies. They didn't say misrepresentation or he got it wrong. They just said he's lying. He's not telling the truth. And they totaled how many lies he was telling. I think we don't do a good job. And the reason I wouldn't give an A to the press, among the reasons I wouldn't give an A, and I would maybe even go a little lower than a B, is we still don't understand Trump voters. And I think we spend too little time among ourselves, particularly on the East and West Coast, and not enough time viewing those people. And when we talk about diversity in newsrooms, we often only talk about racial or ethnic diversity. We don't talk about ideological diversity. And we need more conservatives and more moderate people to get other points of view, because an unspoken bias affects the way people cover things in the press, as it affects how we respond to things as citizens. So I think we don't do a good enough job of, even though we determined in after 2016 we would do a better job, we didn't do a much better job in covering the Trump voters. And we tend to, you know, stereotype them, you know, racists or backlash or angry or, you know, he got 70 million votes. That's a lot of votes. And we have to understand why. And not all those voters, or even most of them, are racists or fascists or, you know, so we have to spend a little more time. Look what happened in the Latino community. I mean, Trump did surprisingly well in Florida among Latinos, not just among the Cubans and the Venezuelans who were predicted to like him, but among evangelical and anti-abortion Catholics who were Latinos. And he got almost half of the Latin vote, which is one of the reasons why he did so well in Miami-Dade County. And so we have to understand that and stop putting people in groups. There's a tendency in the press, it simplifies things, and it's understandable we would do that, but it's also wrong. You cannot group together in one group all Latino voters any more than you can group together in one group all college-educated people as Biden supporters. In fact, we saw that Trump grew his support among college-educated white voters this year.
What could they do? What could the media do moving forward that would include those kind of people in their newsrooms?
Well, one of the things you might do is recruit people from non-Ivy League colleges, one. Recruit people from not from the coast is two. Ask people, look at their clips, see how they've covered things in their past life, and get some sense of who they are as people. And fourth, you got to put people on the ground. You just got to, a good reporter goes out, whether they're liberal or conservative or moderate, if they go out and they interview people and actually listen, which they're supposed to do, they're going to hear things that will be surprising and report them.
Shouldn't the goal be that journalists try to reach for the center always?
I mean, if the President of the United States is lying, you've got our job is to try and approximate and get as close to the truth as we can. He's lying, and you got to report that. You don't look for false equivalency that says, well, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, or conservatives say this, Republicans say that. Our job is to try as best we can to adjudicate the truth. And sometimes you can't. And if someone says, I am in favor of abortion, and someone else says, I am against abortion, you can't say, I, as a journalist, am in favor of abortion, or I'm against abortion. Then you're stepping out of your role as a kind of referee. But the referee calls fouls. And we have to be willing to call fouls.
Ken, you mentioned before that one of the things that could be done is to hire journalists in all the newsrooms of different backgrounds, geographic, political, et cetera. And I would agree with that. My question is, just as everyone claims there's systemic racism in this country, isn't there a systemic orthodoxy, a liberal orthodoxy, in the management and the people who set the tone, who set the narrative? Because you and I know that as reporters, you are sent out with a story. And very often what the assignment of the story dictates what the outcome will be. Then there was Barry Weiss, who quit the op-ed page of the Times over the firing of her boss for allowing a Tom Cotton opinion, which is, it's an opinion page.
I thought the Times should have run the op-ed page piece because it should have, you should have diversity of views allowed. And the complaint that members of the Times staff made, particularly the Black Americans, is that I felt threatened, physically threatened, if you ran that Cotton piece. Well, the President of the United States has made the same argument, which are much more menacing potentially than Senator Cotton. I think we should have had that viewpoint expressed. And the Times could have written and should have written an editorial denouncing that viewpoint.
How much are those gatekeepers hurting media or helping?
I think what we do when we do that is we enforce the view that Donald Trump outrageously has promulgated, that we are fake news, that we are ideological news, that we're out to get him. And I think that's really dangerous to the press. I mean, it used to be that facts were universal. If you read the New York Times, they were universal facts. If you watched Walter Cronkite on CBS in the Vietnam War, it was universal facts. Today, there are no universal facts. I mean, Fox News has its set of facts, and MSNBC and CNN and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have their sets of facts, and people pick and choose what they want. And with social media in the digital age, you can pick and choose your facts. And that's dangerous because as Senator Pat Moynihan, the late Senator Pat Moynihan once said, you're entitled to your opinions, you're not entitled to your own facts. Well, people feel entitled to their own facts. That's why many people accept Donald Trump's claim today that he actually won the election. And there was voter fraud. well, there's no evidence of voter fraud that has come forward yet. And yet he gets away with it, and many people, and he's not allowing a transition to the newly elected president of the United States. That's outrageous. Yeah. And but think about what that does to trust, which is essential for democracy. Just as what's essential for a good free press is trust and the belief that we are not fake news. And we've been hurt by Trump's scandalous attacks on us.
Are they guilty of the lack of trust?
Yeah, but I would go less strong than you just did on that. I mean, when I look at the New York Times reporting on and getting access to Donald Trump's tax returns and reporting how he paid $750 for a couple of years in taxes and how he's basically gotten tax deductions he arguably should not have gotten. That's just good reporting. That's not fake news. He accused it of fake news because it serves his interest to dismiss it. And he does that very often. But I think on balance, I would not have given a B to the press if I thought it was fake news. I don't think it is. But is there too much opinions, particularly on cable newscasts, not just Fox? Yes. And do anchors express opinions? Yes. I mean, some of these anchors are really, Wolf Blitzer, Jake Tapper, they're brilliant anchors. They really do a good job. And I agree with the opinions they often express. But should they be expressing opinions is the question. And when you do as an anchor, you don't come off as a referee anymore. You come off as a partisan and therefore open yourself to attacks by people like Trump who claim fake news. I worry about that.
You said that Trump is a danger because he's such clickbait. And because he is, there is this kind of bizarre reporting of him, which ends up making it hard for the media.
Well, he is. If you look at how the New York Times digital subscriptions have grown, and you look at the audience for cable news networks, how they have grown. They have, as Donald Trump likes to say, and in this case, I think he's telling the truth, you're growing on my back. People are so, we've been so nervous. Every day you wake up, I've been writing a book, and at 4 o'clock, I say, I got to go down and check what crazy Trump has done today, you know? And it draws me into becoming more of a news consumer at a time when I should be writing my book. But that's Trump, and he has that impact. But what happens with that is that if you look at the Times readers are overwhelmingly Democratic and overwhelmingly anti-Trump. And that becomes clickbait. And if you're an editor, can you resist your constituency?
Well, the media is a business. So at what point does that become a conflict? Do they give the customers what they want? Or do they report what they think is important?
Well, you know, it's interesting. 30 years ago, because advertisers, newspapers, and television was so dependent on advertising, what we worried about was the power of advertisers over the content we received. And then more recently, I remember writing in the late 90s and the early 2000s that the worry I had were the suits, the business people at newspapers who sign our checks, who suddenly can see with the digital world, what was getting them, what stories were getting the most clicks. And I feared that they would say, well, let's have more Kim Kardashian stories because that's what the public wanted. Today, another danger has happened, which is the danger of your consumers, of your readers and viewers and listeners. Will they expect and want more anti-Trump, let's say? And our job is not to obey that noise, but basically to stand up and say, hey, wait a second, we're referees. We have a public trust, just as a politician claims to have a public trust. And our public trust is to try and tell the truth without fear or favor and without being stampeded in any direction by what we think our readers, viewers, or listeners want. And it's harder to do that. And it's harder when all the forces in your institution are saying, my God, we're dependent on our readers. Advertising is a shrinking part of our revenue stream. What counts is what subscribers are willing to pay for. And this is what subscribers want. Do you give your readers what they want or viewers what they want? And, you know, ultimately, it's hard to stand up to that, but you have to.
And yet, you know, when government has covered news, it's been worse. I remember living in Italy when Rai was the main source of news. That tells you how long ago it was. And I remember that they'd have a panel of newscasters. And since there were so many political parties in Italy, there'd be six people sitting there and each one of them would give their version of the news. It was insane. You know, it was really weird. But getting back to how we've covered it, you mentioned earlier about the polls and how bad a job they did. One of the problems it seemed to us was that it's become, covering a campaign and election is becoming like covering sports. I mean, every day you want to know, you know, who's winning, who's ahead. And so you look at the polls. And in a way, the way we've covered it is more poll reliant, which is, especially now that the polls are so bad, will that change?
This is an eternal problem in presidential and actually all campaign coverage. It's horse race coverage. We cover a contest like a horse race, who's ahead of the quarter pole. And polling, our reliance on polling, our over-reliance on polling predicts that. And so we wind up trying to create a narrative and a drama and making it like a horse race. And the polling, you can't, it doesn't matter who's ahead of the quarter pole or the eighth pole. It matters who finishes. And what it does, by horse race coverage, what the press has done eternally, this is a problem of many, many decades in the making, is we spend too much time on conflict and clashes and predicting who's ahead, and not enough time on exploring the issues and the character of the candidates.
That's the central question. Given that this is a commerce, media is commerce, as we just discussed, is there a way they could ever find a palatable way, an eat your vegetables way, to simplify and make somewhat interesting a rundown of where the candidates stand on the issues? Something almost no one knew, unless they really dug deep.
But you know, you in order to do that, the press would have to risk being boring, which is something that the people in charge of the press don't want to happen. They don't want to lose their audience with as you call it, eat your spinach coverage that is really boring and important, but boring. And conflict, horse races are interesting to watch, more interesting to watch, and galvanize a bigger audience. And that's what they do. And we succumb, you know, the press becomes like politicians seeking voter approval, or in this case, audience approval and popularity. And, you know, we ought to be criticized for that.
So is this the end of a media era?
Do I think there'll be no horse race coverage in the next presidential race? Do I think that we will risk boring our viewers and readers by an over-reliance on issue, parsing issues? No, I don't think that's going to happen. So in that sense, it's not the end of an era. We'll continue doing that. What it is the end of an era, and it happened before this year, is lack of universal facts, distrust of the press, distrust of government and politicians in general, which, by the way, Donald Trump has fanned that distrust, not just of the press, but of his own government. Those are really troubling issues for a democracy. That's, in that sense, I fear that the end of an era may be this lack of trust of all institutions, the press, the government, the people who run for public, to be public servants, that crystallization of this issue of mistrust, I fear that's an end of an era that is a very harmful one.
And will more attention be paid to digital platforms, or they have the same problem? I mean, look at how they
are now. I mean, it used to be that Google was celebrated, you know, don't be evil. it's neutral. They just give you, you get the results, you do a search, you get the results. You don't pay for it, it's free. Facebook is free, YouTube is free. And so these were lionized institutions. And suddenly, you know, we're learning that they're not so neutral maybe. Maybe they could do more to intervene to prevent false news and false rumors and devastatingly harmful rumors.
So then what, they become the gatekeepers? I mean, they are.
They already are the gatekeeper. The question is, can they be a more neutral gatekeeper? Can they police fake and subversive things from happening on their platforms? And can they do it in a way without intruding on free speech?
And that is
big,
the question.
Big questions.
It's a big question.
The subject of another podcast, which I hope you will join us on in the future, Ken. You have been terrific. Thank you so much.
Bye, guys.
You've been listening to The News Broads with Gina Cerrito, Lynn White, and Judy Licht. Our producer is David Levin, and editing by Jeremiah Bruckhardt.